Welcome, deep divers. Get ready to sharpen your clinical senses because today we're plunging headfirst into a topic that is, well, profoundly important for anyone stepping into the world of healthcare.
Absolutely. Especially for those of you on the front lines, caring for patients when they're at their most vulnerable.
Exactly. We're talking about schizophrenia and related thought disorders, and this isn't just about, you know, memorizing facts from a textbook.
No, not at all. It's about building a real, living understanding, something that will directly inform your compassionate and effective care.
Right. Transforming how you engage with patients facing, honestly, one of life's most challenging illnesses.
And we've pulled together quite a stack of material. Not just any material, mind you.
No, this is good stuff.
Comprehensive nursing guides, expert excerpts, things like schizophrenia, a comprehensive guide for nurses and the instructor schizophrenia and thought disorder guide, really designed to give you the clearest, most actionable picture possible.
So our mission today is pretty clear, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. We want to equip you as future nurses with the essential knowledge. That means helping you truly grasp the key symptoms of schizophrenia.
Uh-huh.
Understand those special concerns that pop up in the nurse-patient relationship.
Right, the therapeutic alliance.
Exactly. And ultimately, arm you with the foundational insights for assessment, intervention, and critically patient education in this incredibly challenging, but I think deeply rewarding field.
Okay, then. Let's unpack this complex illness, maybe starting with some fast facts that really put its pervasive impact into perspective.
Sounds good. It's an illness that touches so many lives. Often, you know, in the shadows.
So when we talk about schizophrenia, it's often misunderstood, right? Often feared, sometimes still heavily stigmatized.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And our sources are clear. It's one of the most severe mental illnesses. It profoundly impacts a person's thought, perception, behavior.
It really changes their relationship with reality itself, disrupts the very fabric of their existence almost.
It does. And what's truly fascinating and just critically important for every nurse to understand is that this isn't some localized problem. It's universal.
Universal. Meme.
Present in all cultures, races, socioeconomic groups right across the globe. This isn't limited by geography or background. It really transcends those boundaries.
So for us, as nurses dealing with diverse patients,
it highlights the deeply biological nature, the non-discriminatory nature of the illness. It reminds us that, you know, no one is immune. It demands our universal understanding and care.
And it has such a significant historical stigma, doesn't it? I mean, beyond the clinical picture, that sheer weight of historical stigma must still heavily influence patients and their families.
Oh, absolutely.
How does that manifest today? And maybe what's our responsibility as future nurses in trying to actively dismantle it?
That's a really powerful and vital question. Yes, that historical stigma persists and it creates huge barriers. It shows up as delayed diagnosis because families might hide symptoms out of shame. Or individuals might resist getting help because they fear judgment. It leads to social isolation, housing insecurity, immense strain on families.
It ripples outwards.
It really does. So as future nurses, your role in actively reducing that stigma is absolutely crucial. It means approaching every single patient with empathy, with informed care, and an unwavering non-judgmental stance.
It's about how we interact.
Precisely. It's about educating the public, yes, but more immediately, it's about the respect and dignity you show in every interaction. Your actions, your words, they can genuinely change how patients and families perceive and cope with the illness.
Yeah.
Fostering an environment where help is sought, not, you know, shunned.
Beyond that deeply personal human cost, there's also this tremendous economic cost, the cost associated with care, the societal burden.
Mm.
It's not just an individual struggle, is it?
No, it's a community-wide one. It touches everything from healthcare budgets to broader social programs.
And that must have implications for us as advocates, too.
Absolutely right. This cost is truly multifaceted. It includes the direct healthcare costs and patient stays, medications, therapy, sure. But it also includes lost productivity due to disability, significant community support services, and that often unseen strain on family caregivers who become the primary support system.
Yeah, the hidden costs.
Exactly. Underscoring these broad implications helps us understand why effective management, early intervention, and robust community support systems are so vital.
Yeah.
So when we look at the epidemiology, the risk factors, we're not just asking who gets it, we're asking when. And how does that impact their journey? And critically, what can we as nurses do about it?
So on that note then, who is most likely to be affected? And when might we typically see it emerge? Are there specific demographics we should be, you know, keenly aware of for early screening or targeted support?
Okay, good questions. The age of onset for schizophrenia is generally earlier than many other mental health conditions. Mm-hmm. Usually it appears in late adolescence or early adulthood, think late teens to early 30s.
That's a critical time in life.
Exactly. It's a critical period for developing independence, building careers, relationships. Mm. So early onset is particularly disruptive. Our sources also emphasize specific gender differences.
Oh.
Yeah. They're often earlier diagnoses and, unfortunately, a poorer prognosis observed in men.
Poorer prognosis in men. Why is that thought to be?
The reasons aren't entirely clear. It's complex. Mm. But it's crucial for your practice because it means your male patients might present earlier, potentially need more intensive or prolonged support. You might need to be extra vigilant screening young men showing subtle changes.
Okay, noted. What about cultural differences?
Well, the overall prevalence is global, as we said. But how symptoms are presented or interpreted can vary across ethnic and cultural groups.
Right. Context matters.
Absolutely. This demands a culturally sensitive assessment. What might be seen as a spiritual experience in one culture could be viewed as a symptom in another. So never jump to conclusions without understanding the patient's cultural background.
And the family connection. Is it strongly genetic?
Yes, there's a significant familial component, a strong genetic predisposition. But, and this is important, it's not a simple single gene inheritance.
It's more complex than that.
Much more complex. It's an interplay of genetic vulnerabilities, environmental triggers, things like prenatal complications, maybe substance use, and neurodevelopmental factors. It's rarely just one thing. That's why a holistic view is so, so important.
So schizophrenia isn't this static condition, right? It unfolds in stages. It's a journey. Understanding this roadmap seems key for us as nurses, helping us anticipate needs and tailor our interventions.
This is absolutely a critical roadmap for your nursing practice because your role shifts dramatically through each period. It often begins subtly with the prodromal period.
Prodromal, meaning?
Meaning early, subtle, often nonspecific symptoms that come before the acute phase. These aren't obvious psychosis. They might be things like increasing social withdrawal, a noticeable decline in school or work performance, maybe mild changes in perception, just a feeling of things aren't quite right.
That sounds incredibly hard to spot. Could be anything.
Exactly. The challenge here is immense because these signs can easily be mistaken for normal teenage angst, depression, or other issues. But your astute observation skills, your thorough history taking, not just from the patient, but often from worried family members who notice those subtle shifts that can make a monumental difference in identifying these early signs.
Catching a whisper before the storm.
Precisely. Then we often transition into the acute illness period. This is frequent when you first encounter a patient in crisis.
Right, in the hospital, usually.
Often, yeah. This phase is characterized by those prominent positive and negative symptoms. The more overt things we'll discuss soon, like clear delusions or hallucinations. Your primary nursing goals here, immediate symptom management, ensuring safety for everyone involved, and starting that crucial work of establishing even a basic level of trust. It's often the most intense phase.
And once treatment starts to work, and things ideally begin to settle, your focus probably shifts again.
Yes, absolutely. Into the stabilization period. During this time, symptoms begin to lessen with treatment, though they might not fully disappear. Some residual stuff might linger.
Okay.
As symptoms lessen, your role shifts towards reinforcing medication adherence, helping them understand why the meds are important, building a more robust therapeutic alliance, and starting patient and family education about the illness and its ongoing management. This is where the patient starts to regain some balance, and you begin laying the groundwork for long-term recovery.
And the long-term goal is recovery, which I imagine is rarely just a straight line, right? Life throws curveballs.
Absolutely. The recovery period is where symptoms are minimal and the individual strives for functional improvement. They're aiming to reclaim their life in the community, maybe returning to work or school, pursuing hobbies, building relationships.
So what's our goal then?
Your nursing goal here is to stress continuity of care, engage them in rehabilitation efforts, support community integration. It's about fostering resilience, equipping them to navigate daily life while managing their illness. But you're spot on. It's not linear.
Relapses happen.
Exactly. It's vital to acknowledge the reality of relapses. They are common challenges, defined as the recurrence of acute symptoms. Your patient education on recognizing personal warning signs of a relapse, developing effective stress management techniques, and understanding prevention strategies becomes absolutely vital here. It helps minimize their frequency and severity.
Empowering them.
Yes, empowering them to be active participants in their own long-term well-being.
Now, it's pretty rare for schizophrenia to exist in isolation, isn't it? This illness often weaves this complex tapestry with other conditions, which must complicate care and demand a truly holistic approach from us as nurses.
Oh, this interconnectedness is a significant and often challenging reality in your practice. For instance, substance abuse and depression are, frankly, shockingly prevalent comorbidities.
Why is that?
Well, substance use can tragically exacerbate psychotic symptoms, interfere with medication effectiveness, or maybe serve as a maladaptive coping mechanism for the immense distress of the illness itself.
Self-medicating, in a way.
Sometimes, yes. Yeah. And depression is a huge concern on its own, dramatically increasing the risk of suicide, which is already tragically elevated in schizophrenia.
So what do we do?
You'll need to assess for these carefully and systematically in every patient. They directly impact treatment, prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
You often need integrated treatment plans addressing both mental health and substance abuse concurrently. Ignoring one means you're not truly treating the whole person.
It's not just other mental health challenges, right? We're talking serious physical health issues too.
Absolutely. And this is where your holistic nursing skills really come into play. Diabetes, mellitus, and obesity are also commonly seen. Alarmingly, individuals with schizophrenia often have a significantly shorter life expectancy due to these and other general medical conditions.
Why is that connection so strong?
It's often linked to the side effects of antipsychotic medications, particularly weight gain. Also, lifestyle factors impacted by the illness itself, reduced physical activity, maybe poor dietary choices, barriers to accessing preventative care.
So our role goes way beyond just mental health.
Significantly beyond. You'll be promoting health, providing crucial nutritional guidance, teaching about exercise, meticulously monitoring metabolic parameters like blood glucose, lipids. It's about ensuring overall physical well-being, not just symptom management, to truly improve their quality of life and, frankly, their longevity.
Okay, now let's get into the heart of what schizophrenia actually looks like. The symptoms fall into these distinct categories, right? And understanding them isn't just for diagnosis. It's crucial for your moment-to-moment assessment and how you interact with the patient. It's about decoding the illness.
That's exactly right. When you're looking at diagnostic criteria, the symptoms really fall into three main buckets. First, we have positive symptoms.
Positive means?
Think of these as things that are added to the person's experience that shouldn't be their excessive or distorted thoughts and perceptions, like delusions and hallucinations. They're often the most dramatic and readily observable symptoms.
Okay, added things. Got it.
Then there are negative symptoms. These represent diminished emotions and behaviors. These are losses of normal functions, like a lack of emotional expression or motivation. They can be more subtle, but often profoundly impact a patient's daily life.
So positive is added, negative is lost.
Exactly. And finally, cognitive symptoms. These impact executive functioning, essentially hitting how a person thinks, processes information, makes decisions.
That sounds debilitating too.
It really can be. And it's important to remember, for a formal diagnosis of schizophrenia, these clinical manifestations require symptoms to be present for a significant chunk of time. Active symptoms for at least 1 month, and persistent signs of disturbance for at least 6 months total.
Ah, the duration criteria.
Yes, that's key to differentiating it from other briefer psychotic disorders we might touch on later.
Okay, let's start with delusions then. These are often what people first associate with schizophrenia, right? Those fixed, false beliefs. But they're far more nuanced than just odd thoughts. These sound like they're deeply entrenched, often terrifying, and completely real for the person experiencing them.
Precisely. Delusions are erroneous, fixed, false beliefs. They are resistant to logical argument, reason, or evidence. It's not just a difference of opinion, it's a misinterpretation of experience that cannot be changed by telling them they're wrong.
So arguing is pointless.
Worse than pointless, often counterproductive. As a nurse, you'll encounter several types. For example, a delusion of grandeur. That's an exaggerated sense of self-importance or power.
Like believing they're famous.
Exactly. Believing they're a famous historical figure or possess special godlike abilities like controlling the weather. Then there's the nihilistic delusion.
Nihilistic.
Where a patient believes life is meaningless or even that they are dead or non-existent. They might say things like, my organs have rotted away. I'm just an empty shell.
Wow. That sounds incredibly disturbing. A terrifying internal reality for them.
They are. And they profoundly impact a patient's sense of self, their future. Another type, and one that demands immediate clinical attention, is persecutory delusions.
Persecutory, like paranoia.
Yes, exactly. The client believes they're being harassed, tormented, spied upon, or persecuted by some external force, often a shadowy organization, the government, maybe specific individuals. It could manifest as, the government is spying on me through my TV, or, really concerningly, my food is poisoned by the nurses.
Okay, that's serious.
Extremely. Our sources specifically ask a critical nursing question here. As a nurse, which delusion would concern you the most? And the answer, unequivocally, is persecutory delusions.
Why that one specifically?
Because the client may perceive a threat so intensely that they believe they must act to protect themselves. Or they might feel commanded by these perceived persecutors to harm themselves or someone else. This is a crucial safety assessment for you and your entire team. It requires immediate attention, careful intervention. Your vigilance here is paramount.
Understood. Any other types?
Yes. Also somatic delusions. These involve a belief that one's body is changing or diseased without any physical basis. Things like, there are bugs crawling under my skin, or my heart has stopped beating, but I'm still alive.
So, as a nurse, you're faced with a patient utterly convinced of these realities. What's the biggest mistake a new nurse might make when encountering someone with such a profound delusion? And how do we avoid it?
That's a vital question. The biggest mistake, as we touched on, is trying to argue with the delusion or convince the patient it's not real. Imagine someone telling you your most deeply held belief is false.
It's invalidating.
Exactly. It's invalidating and can escalate agitation or paranoia. Instead, your nursing approach is to never argue with the delusion. You acknowledge their experience and feelings.
How do you do that without validating the delusion itself?
You focus on the emotion. I understand you believe this is happening, and that must be frightening for you.
Mm-hmm.
You validate their feeling, not the content of the delusion. Then, gently, you can reorient to reality by stating what you know to be true, without hammering it home. I don't see any bugs, but I can see you're distressed.
Okay. Acknowledge the feeling, gently state reality.
And most importantly, continuously ensure safety. Monitor for any intent to harm self or others, especially with persecutory or command delusions. Consistency, honesty, and a calm, reassuring presence are your most powerful tools.
Okay. Moving from fixed beliefs to perceptions, hallucinations, another hallmark positive symptom. This is where a person experiences things that simply aren't there, and for them, it's as real as anything we're experiencing right now.
Yes. Hallucinations are perceptual experiences that occur without any actual external sensory stimuli. They can involve any of the five senses a patient might hear, see, feel, taste, or even smell things that aren't present.
Which are most common?
Auditory hallucinations, hearing voices, are by far the most common. About 70% of patients experience them. These voices can be critical, commenting, conversing, or even issuing commands.
Commands, like telling them to do things.
Yes, that's a major safety concern, similar to persecutory delusions. Visual hallucinations are also significant, seeing shadows, figures, distorted objects. When assessing, you need to ask specific questions.
Such as?
Are you hearing voices? What are they saying? Do you recognize them? Are they telling you to do anything? Be direct.
Okay, now here's a key distinction for our practice. What's the difference between an illusion and a hallucination? And why does that matter for us?
It absolutely matters, and misunderstanding it can lead to misdirected care. An illusion is a brief misinterpretation of an actual existing external stimulus.
Like seeing a coat rack in the dark.
Perfect example. Seeing a coat rack in a dimly lit room and momentarily thinking it's a person standing there. There's something real that is being misinterpreted. A hallucination, however, has zero basis in external reality. There is no coat rack, no sound, nothing there to misinterpret. It's an internal generation of a sensory experience, a complete disconnect from external stimuli.
Okay, illusion, misinterpretation of something real. Hallucination, perception of something not real at all.
Precisely. And our sources highlight, what is the first priority when dealing with patients who are experiencing either one?
Safety.
Always safety. The safety of the patient, staff, and others. This means you must thoroughly assess the content of the hallucination for any command components that could lead to harm. If a patient says, the voices are telling me to jump out the window, your immediate action is safety protocols. Ensure they aren't near a window. Initiate one-on-one observation. Rapidly involve the team. Your assessment of the danger potential is paramount.
Got it. Beyond these dramatic positive symptoms, there are often subtle but profound cognitive challenges. You mentioned these impact daily life significantly, arguably as debilitating, maybe even more so than the more visible symptoms.
They often are. These cognitive symptoms are less visible, often harder to treat, but can be incredibly debilitating, really affecting a patient's ability to function independently. Patients often experience significant difficulty understanding information. Complex instructions become a huge barrier.
Makes sense.
They might have trouble paying attention, struggling to focus on conversations or tasks. There's also often an inability to use information after learning it, which impacts problem solving and adaptive behavior.
So memory issues too.
Yes, you'll see impairment in memory, both short and long term, a reduction in verbal fluency, significant issues with executive functioning, things like planning, abstract thinking, organization, decision making.
And this is critical for how we approach patient education, right?
Absolutely critical. Imagine trying to teach a patient about their complex medication regimen when they're struggling with attention and memory. It's almost impossible using standard methods.
So what do we do?
You'll need to use simple, concrete language. Break tasks into tiny, manageable steps. Use frequent repetition. Visual aids. Your creativity in teaching will be truly tested here.
Okay. While positive symptoms are these excesses, negative symptoms represent a loss of normal emotional and behavioral capabilities. You said these can be particularly challenging for patients and families, partly because they can be easily misinterpreted.
That's very true. And this is where a nurse's keen observation and empathy are crucial. Negative symptoms are characterized by a reduction or absence of normal functions. A common one is flat affect.
Flat affect? Like no emotion?
A severe lack of emotional expression. Patient might have a blank stare, speak in a monotone, even when discussing emotional topics. They also experience general difficulty expressing emotion, which can be really frustrating for family members trying to connect.
I can imagine.
Ambivalence is also common, the coexistence of contradictory attitudes or feelings. It often presents as difficulty making decisions or integrating information, like trying to decide what to wear or eat, but being paralyzed by conflicting thoughts.
Indecisiveness.
To an extreme degree, yes. Then there's avolition.
Avolition.
A profound lack of motivation or initiative for purposeful activities. They might struggle to even start or complete basic tasks like brushing their teeth or getting dressed. It looks like laziness, but it's not.
It's part of the illness.
Exactly. And anhedonia, the inability to experience pleasure. Previously enjoyable activities feel dull or meaningless. That's a crushing loss, contribute to immense suffering.
Leads to isolation.
Tragically, yes. This often leads to withdrawal and severe isolation, cutting off from friends, family, community. For you as a nurse, it's vital to remember these symptoms can be easily mistaken for laziness, disinterest, or unwillingness to cooperate.
But they're not.
They are not. Your understanding helps you recognize them as integral parts of the illness, requiring different, more gentle approaches, emphasizing small, achievable steps, genuine encouragement rather than, you know, pushing too hard.
Okay. Now, the way thoughts are processed and expressed can become incredibly disordered too, making communication really difficult, often frustrating for everyone involved. This seems like a huge area for nurses to understand.
This category, disorganized thinking or thought disorder, is absolutely vital for you to recognize. It directly impacts your ability to communicate effectively, to build that therapeutic relationship. Our sources list many examples, and yeah, it's a lot to take in, but let's focus on some you'll most frequently encounter and must recognize.
Okay, hit me with the main ones.
Right. Loose associations. This is a core feature. The patient's thought patterns are disconnected, illogical. They jump from one topic to another without a clear, discernible link.
Like their train of thought derails.
Exactly. And trying to force them back onto your logical track can actually increase their anxiety. Your goal isn't to fix their logic, but to create a safe space, gently recenter if needed, maybe focus on their immediate feelings rather than the fragmented content.
Okay, what else?
Word salad. This is a severe form of loose associations, an incoherent mixture of words and phrases with no logical connection at all, like window, elephant blue, jump, run.
Just random words.
Completely random.
Yeah.
When you hear this, it's a clear sign of severe thought disorganization. Communication needs to be super simple, direct, focused on immediate needs, safety, comfort.
Got it. Word salad easily severe disorganization.
Then neologisms. These are new words that speaker coins that have meaning only to them.
Yeah.
If a patient says, I need my flumphador to feel safe, recognize it as a neologism. Don't waste time trying to figure out what flumphador really means.
Just accept it as their word.
For the moment, yes. Acknowledge they need something they call a flumphador.
Mm.
Also, concrete thinking. The inability to think abstractly, interpreting things literally.
Like if you ask, what brought you to the hospital?
And they reply, an ambulance.
Yeah.
Instead of describing their symptoms. That's concrete thinking. So You need to avoid idioms, metaphors. Use simple, direct, literal communication.
Okay. Avoid abstract language.
And perseveration. This is the persistent repetition of a word, phrase, or gesture, even when the topic has changed. It can be frustrating, but understand it's part of the illness, not intentional obstruction.
Those seem like the big ones to recognize for communication.
They are. Others you might see include echolalia, repeating your words. Circumstantiality, long-winded, but eventually gets to the point. Tangentiality, drifts off and never returns. Flight of ideas, rapid topic shifts, often with mania. Paranoia, referential thinking, believing news reports are personal messages. Artistic thinking, Boyler's term for inner preoccupation. Verbigeration, repeating meaningless words. Metonymic speech, using related words. Clang associations, rhyming words. Stilted language, overly formal. And pressured speech, rapid, urgent.
Wow, okay, that's a lot.
It is. But for you, recognizing these patterns helps you accurately assess their thought process and, crucially, adapt your communication. Meet them where they are, don't force them into your logical framework.
And it's not just thoughts. Behavior can also become highly disorganized and unpredictable. That must pose unique challenges, often raising immediate safety concerns.
Indeed. Disorganized behaviors are often what bring patients into care, and they require careful assessment and management. Aggression or agitation can be triggered by internal stimuli, those command hallucinations or persecutory delusions we talked about, or by external stressors.
So what's our role?
Recognizing early signs of escalating agitation, using de-escalation techniques calmly and confidently, and ensuring a safe environment for everyone. Then there's catatonia.
Catatonia, I've heard of that. What does it look like?
It's a severe manifestation of abnormal movement and behavior. It can include stupor or mutism, unresponsive or unable to speak. Rigidity, stiff, unmoving posture.
Mm-hmm.
Posturing, holding unusual, often awkward positions for extended periods. Negativism, active resistance to instructions or attempts to move them. Or even excitement, purposeless, excessive motor activity, often called catatonic excitement, which can be exhausting and dangerous.
That sounds really serious.
It is. Other behaviors include echopraxia, involuntarily copying your movements. Regress behavior, returning to earlier, less mature behaviors like childlike babbling or incontinence. Stereotypy, repetitive, purposeless movements like rocking or headbanging. Hypervigilance, excessive alertness, often due to paranoia. And waxy flexibility.
Waxy flexibility.
Where the patient's limbs or body parts can be placed in awkward positions and will remain there for extended periods like a wax statue. It's quite striking. These behaviors can pose significant safety risks, and they deeply challenge your ability to provide even basic care. Requires careful assessment, immense patience, and appropriate individualized interventions to ensure safety and dignity.
Okay, let's check our understanding quickly. This is a common point of confusion for new nurses, apparently.
Yeah.
True or false? Hallucinations are considered positive symptoms, but delusions are considered negative symptoms.
Oh, good one. That is false. Both hallucinations and delusions are considered positive symptoms. Remember, positive means they're excesses or distortions of normal functions, things added to a person's experience, not a loss of function.
Right. Positive added, negative lost. Got it.
Exactly. It's a common mix-up, so it's really important for you to get that straight in your head.
So while we see these incredibly impactful symptoms on the outside, what's happening beneath the surface? What does the science tell us about the brain's role? Understanding the why seems like it helps us understand why treatments work and reinforces the need for compassion, recognizing this as a biological illness.
Absolutely. Our current understanding points to a complex interplay in the brain. We have neuroanatomic findings, studies showing subtle but significant differences, like smaller brain volume in certain areas, particularly the prefrontal cortex and hippocampus. These suggest structural differences contribute to the illness.
Changes in the brain itself?
Yes. There are clear familial patterns and genetic associations showing that strong inherited predisposition we mentioned, though again, not a single gene, but a complex interaction of many genes plus environmental factors.
Nature and nurture.
Pretty much. It's also often conceptualized as a neurodevelopmental disorder, meaning the processes contributing likely begin much earlier in life, even prenatally or in early childhood, rather than just appearing suddenly in adulthood.
Okay. And the chemicals, neurotransmitters.
Right. Perhaps the biggest player we know about, especially related to those positive symptoms, involves neurotransmitters, pathways, and receptors. Specifically, the prevailing theory points to dopamine hyperactivity.
Too much dopamine.
Think of the brain like a finely tuned orchestra. In schizophrenia, it's as if the dopamine section usually involved in motivation, reward, filtering information has suddenly started playing way too loud, drowning out everything else. This excessive activity in the brain's dopamine system is thought to be a key contributor to positive symptoms like delusions and hallucinations.
Okay. That makes sense why the medications target dopamine then.
Exactly. Many antipsychotic medications target dopamine receptors, aiming to essentially turn down that overwhelming volume. Your understanding of this helps demystify the illness, grounding it in biology, and reinforces why pharmacologic interventions are often a cornerstone of treatment.
Okay, let's get practical again. When you're caring for someone with schizophrenia, what are the absolute top priorities you need to address? Your non-negotiables, the things that dictate immediate actions.
Right, the critical priorities. Drawing directly from our sources, for you, the nurse, these are paramount. First, number one, suicide assessment.
Always number one.
Always. The risk is tragically high. Individuals experiencing psychosis can be commanded by voices to harm themselves, or they might feel profound hopelessness. You must always perform a thorough suicide risk assessment. Ask direct, clear questions about suicidal thoughts, any plans, access to means, and ensure a safe environment. No beating around the bush. Be direct. Take all threats seriously.
Okay. Suicide assessment first. What's next?
Second, aggression and safety. Ensuring the safety of the patient, yourself, staff, other patients. It's non-negotiable. Especially with those persecutory delusions where a patient feels genuinely threatened and might lash out, or with command hallucinations telling them to hurt someone.
So constant vigilance.
Acute awareness of potential triggers, skill in de-escalation techniques, implementing environmental safety measures. Your calm, confident presence and demeanor are powerful tools here, often diffusing tension before it escalates.
Right. And third.
Third, antipsychotic medications. They are the cornerstone of treatment for managing symptoms. Your role isn't just handing them out. It's diligently monitoring their effectiveness. Are symptoms improving? And, critically, watching for side effects. Which leads us right into a crucial area for your knowledge and intervention.
Okay, so priorities are suicide risk, safety aggression, and medication management monitoring. Got it. But before you can intervene effectively, you need that thorough nursing assessment. What exactly are you looking for when you first engage with the patient? What's in your mental toolkit?
This is your foundation for care, your comprehensive detective work. A thorough assessment gives you the full picture. You'll be looking at their responses to mental health problems. How do they cope? What's their perception of their illness? Do they have insight?
Insight is huge.
Crucial. Their mental status and appearance, how they present, hygiene, overall look. Assess their mood and effect. Is it consistent? Is it appropriate to the situation? Flat? Labile.
Speech patterns too, right?
Definitely. Speech patterns reveal a lot, rate, rhythm, content. I can expect those disorganized thinking symptoms we discussed. Of course, meticulously assess thought processes, logical, coherent, or disorganized loose associations, word salad.
Hallucinations and delusions.
Absolutely. The presence of hallucinations and delusions requires detailed assessment of their content, frequency, intensity, and critically, any command nature. Note any disorganized communication you observe. Pay close attention to cognitive impairments, memory, orientation, attention, because these affect how you communicate and teach.
Insight and judgment.
Yes. Insight and judgment are crucial. Their awareness of illness, ability to make sound decisions, observe their behavioral responses, aggression, agitation, catatonia, understand their self-concept, stress, and coping patterns, map out their social network, who are their supports, are there any...
Risk assessment again.
Always. Perform a comprehensive risk assessment for suicide and violence, ongoing. And finally, a detailed medication assessment. What are they taking? Are they taking it? Any side effects they're experiencing? This comprehensive approach ensures you get that full, nuanced picture, which then, and only then, guides your interventions effectively.
Okay, so you've assessed. Now, what do you actually do? The interventions sound multifaceted, covering both physical and psychosocial domains, ensuring holistic care. Because the illness really does impact every part of a person.
Absolutely. Your interventions need to address the whole person. In the physical domain, you'll be promoting self-care activities, ADLs, hygiene, which can be severely challenged by negative symptoms like avolition.
Helping them with basics.
Sometimes, yes. You'll implement activity, exercise, and nutritional interventions crucial for combating medication side effects like weight gain and promoting overall health. You'll also address thermoregulation.
Temperature. Why is that important?
It's often overlooked but vital. Certain antipsychotics can disrupt the body's natural temperature regulation, making patients susceptible to overheating or hypothermia. So monitoring their environment and comfort isn't just basic care. It's a specific medication-related safety concern.
Okay, good to know.
And you'll promote normal fluid balance, actively working to prevent water intoxication. It's rare, but a serious risk in some chronic mental illnesses. Can lead to hyponatremia, seizures.
Wow. Okay.
So monitoring fluid intake and output can be important too.
And central to physical care for schizophrenia is pharmacologic intervention, the antipsychotics. You said vigilance is paramount here.
Precisely. For pharmacologic interventions, antipsychotics are the cornerstone. You'll administer them, yes, but more importantly, monitor effectiveness. Are positive symptoms reducing? Negative symptoms improving? And diligently watch for side effects.
Like what?
We'll get into specifics, but things like movement disorders. Anticholinergics are often used alongside antipsychotics to manage some of those side effects. And it's worth noting, while not a typical antipsychotic, lithium is a salt, primarily used for bipolar, but sometimes prescribed in mood disorders with psychotic features. It has its own monitoring needs, especially around fluid balance and kidney function. Your understanding of each medication, its purpose, dosage, and potential side effects is absolutely crucial.
Right. And you mentioned side effects become really critical, especially extrapyramidal side effects, or EPS. For nurses, recognizing these immediately sounds like it can make a huge difference.
Indeed. EPS are drug-induced movement disorders. Your ability to identify them is vital. Early detection can often prevent them from becoming permanent or severely impacting a patient's quality of life and their willingness to take meds.
So what are the main types of EPS we need to watch for?
Okay, let's break them down. First, Parkinsonism. This involves symptoms similar to Parkinson's disease tremors, muscle rigidity, bradykinesia, which is slowness of movement. You might notice a shuffling gait, a mask, expressionless face.
Okay, looks like Parkinson's, but caused by the meds.
Exactly. Then anticholinergic effects. These are common with many psych meds, not just antipsychotics used for EPS. Things like dry mouth, blurred vision, constipation, urinary retention. Uncomfortable, but generally manageable with interventions like sugar-free candy, fluids, fiber.
Annoying, but not usually dangerous.
Generally, yeah. But then you have dystonic reactions. These are acute, involuntary muscle contractions. They can be quite frightening for the patient and alarming to witness.
Like muscle spasms?
Severe ones. Examples include torticollis, where the neck twists painfully to one side, or oculogeric crisis, where the eyes roll back uncontrollably. These are considered medical emergencies requiring immediate intervention, usually with an anticholinergic medication like Benadryl or Cogenica.
Okay, dystonia emergency. Got it.
Then there's akathisia. This is an inner restlessness, an intense subjective feeling of unease and an inability to sit still. Patients often pace, fidget, constantly shift their weight. They might describe it as feeling like they need to crawl out of their skin.
That sounds awful.
It is incredibly distressing. I once had a patient so distressed by akathisia, they couldn't sit still for even a minute, pacing constantly, practically vibrating with restlessness. Recognizing it immediately as akathisia and EPS, not just general agitation, allowed us to quickly intervene with medication and bring them profound relief. Your vigilance here is their comfort. It's often undertreated because it can look like anxiety.
So don't just assume it's anxiety. Consider akathisia.
Always consider akathisia with antipsychotics. And finally, tardive dyskinesia.
TD.
TD. That's the one I've heard is often irreversible.
Unfortunately, yes. That's why prevention and early detection are key. TD is one of the most serious side effects. It's a chronic, often irreversible, involuntary movement disorder.
What does it look like?
Characterized by repetitive, uncontrolled movements, typically of the face, like grimacing, lip smacking, tongue protrusion, and sometimes the limbs or trunk. It comes from long-term antipsychotic use.
So what's our role with TD? Careful, ongoing monitoring and prompt reporting. Prevention is key, which means using the lowest effective dose of antipsychotics for the shortest necessary time and regular screening. You'll be using tools like the AIMS scale Abnormal Involuntary Movement Scale to systematically track for any early signs of these movements. Early detection might allow for medication changes before it becomes severe or permanent.
Okay, so beyond crisis management and medication, nursing care is fundamentally about empowering patients and their families, right? Looking at the long game of recovery, it's about building bridges, especially when the illness itself tries to isolate people.
This is where the psychosocial domain of nursing care truly shines, and honestly, it's deeply rewarding. The development of a nurse-patient relationship is absolutely crucial, foundational.
Especially with paranoia and disorganized thinking.
Exactly. Building trust, showing acceptance, instilling hope, these are paramount. Your consistent, honest, and non-judgmental approach is key. For a paranoid patient, this means things like avoiding whispering, maintaining an open body posture, never challenging their belief directly, but acknowledging their feeling of fear and offering concrete assurances of safety. This therapeutic alliance is the bedrock for everything else.
So the relationship comes first.
It has to. Then you'll be involved in the management of disturbed thoughts and sensory perceptions, teaching coping strategies for hallucinations and delusions.
Like what kind of strategies?
Things like distraction techniques, reality testing. Are others hearing that voice too? Sometimes even structured ways of talking back to the voices or engaging intensely in reality-based activities like music or conversation. Education about symptoms is also key, helping patients understand their illness, not just taking medication blindly because someone told them to.
Empowering them with knowledge.
Yes. You'll also work on the enhancement of cognitive functioning, developing strategies to manage difficulties with attention and memory, using written reminders, breaking down complex tasks into simple steps, using routines. Behavioral interventions are used to address maladaptive behaviors, maybe using token economies or social skills training.
Coping with stress must be huge, too.
Crucially important. Teaching and coping with stress, helping patients identify their personal triggers and develop healthy responses like deep breathing, exercise, journaling, reaching out for support, and of course, extensive patient education about their medication, purpose, side effects, importance of adherence, self-care strategies, and recognizing early warning signs of relapse.
And family education, too.
Absolutely critical. Comprehensive family education to foster support, understanding, reduce caregiver burden, and provide them with crisis management skills. Families are often the main support system, and they need tools, too. This is truly where your therapeutic communication skills shine, fostering a sense of partnership and empowering patients and families on their recovery journey.
So what does successful treatment and recovery actually look like for individuals with schizophrenia? It's not always a cure in the traditional sense, is it? It's more about maximizing potential and living a life with meaning.
Exactly. Our sources define success as significant improvement or recovery, enabling individuals to lead functional lives. That might mean living independently, maintaining a job or attending school, engaging in meaningful social relationships. It looks different for everyone.
And continuity of care is key.
A major goal of recovery is continuity of care. No one gets better or stays well in isolation. Consistent support from family, friends, case managers, therapists, the whole healthcare team is vital to navigate life's challenges and prevent relapse.
Building that support network.
Yes. This also involves mental health promotion with a positive support system for stressful periods, essentially preparing patients for life's inevitable challenges and equipping them with the tools and network to navigate them effectively. It's about living well with the illness, managing symptoms, and achieving personal goals, not just avoiding hospitalization.
Now, as nurses, we also need to be acutely aware of the worst-case scenarios so we can actively work to prevent them. Ensuring the best possible outcomes means knowing the biggest risks. These are the things that, you know, keep us vigilant.
Absolutely. The worst possible complications of schizophrenia, as highlighted in our sources, directly point to what you must actively work to prevent. First, and critically, as we've stressed, suicide or harm to others.
Back to priority one.
Always. We've reiterated this as the number one priority for your assessment and intervention, given the potential for command hallucinations and persecutor delusions. Your vigilance, your direct questioning, your safety planning it can literally save lives. Proactive screening, safe environment, immediate intervention when risk is identified.
Okay. What else is on that worst complications list?
Second is non-compliance with treatment, or maybe better term, challenges with adherence. Patients might stop taking medication for many reasons, distressing side effects like the EPS I discussed, maybe a lack of insight into their illness, anosognosia, or the pervasive stigma they face.
So what's our role there?
Your role in patient education, building that trusting relationship we talked about, actively listening to their concerns about side effects, and advocating for patient-centered treatment plans is crucial. That might mean working with a prescriber to find medication with fewer side effects, or advocating for long-acting injectable medications if remembering daily pills is a consistent issue. Improving adherence is key to preventing relapse.
Makes sense. And third?
Third, diabetes and obesity and related cardiovascular issues. We've discussed these physical health comorbidities. They're often direct consequences of medication side effects and lifestyle factors impacted by the illness, leading to that drastically reduced life expectancy.
So our role is proactive physical health care.
Vital. Proactive physical health monitoring, checking weight, blood pressure, blood sugar, lipids, providing nutritional guidance, education on exercise, collaborating with primary care. It's essential to prevent these severe physical health complications. These are the hard realities you will face and why your comprehensive, informed, and proactive care is so incredibly vital.
Now, schizophrenia isn't the only condition where psychosis appears. It seems important for us as future nurses to understand some related disorders. Helps with differential diagnosis and clinical practice, right? Making sure the patient gets the right treatment for their specific challenge.
This is a key area for your assessment skills. Distinguishing between similar presentations that might look like schizophrenia, but have crucial differences, often in duration or suspected cause. First, there's schizophreniform disorder.
Schizophreniform? Sounds like schizophrenia.
It does. Psychosis is its defining feature, and the symptoms are identical to schizophrenia criteria. Delusions, hallucinations, disorganized thinking, negative symptoms, the whole picture. The critical difference, duration.
How long?
Symptoms must be present for at least 1 month, but, and this is key, for less than 6 months. Remember, schizophrenia requires at least 6 months of disturbance.
Okay. So it's shorter. What's the prognosis?
Our sources note that approximately 1/3 of individuals recover fully from schizophreniform disorder. But significantly, 2/3 will unfortunately go on to develop full schizophrenia.
So it's kind of like a potential precursor.
Exactly. Your initial diagnosis and close monitoring here are key. It informs early intensive interventions that might potentially alter that trajectory for some. It's almost like a temporary schizophrenia, but with a high risk of becoming permanent. A diagnostic holding pattern in a way.
Got it. What's next?
Next we have brief psychotic disorder. Again, psychosis is the defining feature, but the length of the episode is very short.
How short?
At least 1 day, but less than 1 month. Then a full return to premorbid functioning.
Wow, just a month max.
Yes. The onset is typically sudden, often following a significant psychosocial stressor. There's usually at least one prominent positive symptom, a delusion or hallucination. Patients often experience intense emotional turmoil, overwhelming confusion, rapid, intense shifts of affect. It can sometimes be mistaken for a bipolar episode because of that emotional volatility.
But it resolves quickly.
Yes, by definition, it resolves within a month. But while it's brief, the impairment during the episode can be severe, leading to significant distress and functional impairment. Your quick assessment, ensuring safety during the episode, and providing support are critical in these acute, short-lived, but often intense episodes.
Okay. Schizophreniform is 1 to 6 months. Brief psychotic is less than 1 month. What else?
Then there are cases where substance use can mimic a primary psychotic disorder. This is another crucial differential you'll need to assess for immediately. We call this psychotic disorder attributable to a substance.
So the psychosis is caused by the substance.
Directly caused by it. Prominent hallucinations or delusions that are judged to be due to the physiological effects of a substance, a drug of abuse, a medication, toxin exposure that is present in the body.
How long do the symptoms last?
They generally continue as long as the substance use continues. And withdrawal symptoms, which can also include psychosis for some substances, can occur for up to about 4 weeks after stopping.
So history taking is crucial here.
Absolutely essential. Your thorough history taking regarding substance use, asking specifically about drug use, meth, cocaine, cannabis, etc., prescription medications, even over-the-counter substances, is critical to differentiate this from a primary psychotic disorder like schizophrenia. The treatment approach is fundamentally different, focusing on substance cessation, detoxification, and treating the addiction. You wouldn't treat substance-induced psychosis long-term with antipsychotics in the same way you treat schizophrenia.
Okay, that makes sense. Finally, let's look at a classic framework. From way back in 1911, Eugen Bleuler, one of the pioneers in understanding schizophrenia, he gave us Bleuler's 4 A's, a way of understanding the core features that, remarkably, still seems helpful today.
It really does. This historical perspective provides you with a foundational understanding of the core disruptions in schizophrenia that we still recognize clinically. Bleuler identified 4 primary or fundamental symptoms, the A's.
Okay, what's the first A?
The first A is autism. But it's really important to understand this in Bleuler's original 1911 context. This does not refer to the developmental disorder, autism spectrum disorder, we know today.
Okay, different meaning back then.
Completely. For Bleuler, autism referred to a profound loss of awareness of external events, a preoccupation with oneself and inner thoughts and fantasies. Essentially, losing touch with external reality, withdrawing into an internal world.
How does that relate to nursing practice?
It directly impacts social engagement and the patient's ability to connect with you. It makes establishing rapport difficult because they are, in a sense, living primarily in their own internal world.
Okay. Autism inner preoccupation withdrawal. What's the next A?
The next A is affect. This refers to that diminished emotional response to stimuli we talked about, with negative symptoms often presenting as flat or inappropriate affect.
So the blunted emotions.
Exactly. This challenges your ability to gauge the patient's true emotional state and respond appropriately, because their outward expression might not match their internal experience, or might be completely incongruent with the situation. You learn to look beyond the surface, listen carefully to content.
Right. Affect, diminish an appropriate emotional response. Third A.
The third A is associations, specifically what we now call loose associations. This is that disordered pattern of thought, the lack of logical connection between ideas, leading to tangential or circumstantial speech.
The disorganized thinking.
Precisely. It directly impacts your ability to understand and communicate with the patient, as their speech might jump erratically from topic to topic. You'll need patience, clarifying questions, concrete language.
Associations, loose, disordered thinking. And the final A.
The final A is ambivalence. This is the inability to make decisions, being unable to integrate and process conflicting information or feelings simultaneously, holding opposing feelings or thoughts at the same time without being able to resolve them.
Like the indecisiveness we mentioned earlier.
Yes, but a profound difficulty with integrating conflicting ideas or emotions. For you and the patient, this can make treatment planning, goal setting, even simple daily choices incredibly challenging, leading to hesitation or paralysis in action.
Ambivalence, inability to decide, integrate conflicting thoughts.
Exactly. Together, Bleuler's four A's, autism, inner preoccupation, affect, blunted emotion, associations, loose thinking, and ambivalence, indecision, paint a picture of the core disruptions in reality, connection, emotion, thought, and volition that characterize schizophrenia. It offers a timeless lens, a foundational framework through which to understand the illness. #tagoutro.
Wow. Okay. We have covered a lot today. We've journeyed from understanding the profound impact of schizophrenia, those intense positive symptoms like delusions and hallucinations, to the subtle but really debilitating negative and cognitive symptoms. We've critically examined how you, as a nurse, are right there at the forefront, providing holistic, potentially life-changing care.
Differentiating it from related psychotic disorders.
Right, and even revisited that timeless Bleuler framework to deepen our understanding. This isn't just theory, is it? It's about real people, real care, real challenges.
It really is. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, just remember that while schizophrenia presents profound, often lifelong challenges, your informed, your empathetic, your safety-focused care can fundamentally improve the lives of these individuals.
Seeing the person, not just the illness.
Exactly. Seeing beyond the illness to the person. Offering stability when their world feels utterly chaotic. Advocating for their physical and mental well-being in a system that, let's be honest, often struggles to meet their complex needs.
Yeah.
And this raises, I think, an important question for you to consider as you move forward in your nursing career. How will your understanding of these complex symptoms, this deep dive we've done today, shape your commitment to advocating for patients who often struggle to advocate for themselves? How will it fuel you to foster dignity and hope in every single interaction and truly become their champion?
That is a powerful thought to carry with you as you step into your practice. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep learning, keep questioning, and keep making that profound difference in the lives of those you care for.
Absolutely.
We'll catch you on the next deep dive.